You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Joyce Carol Oates is the recipient of the National Book Award and the Pan Malamud Award for Excellence in Short Fiction. She's written some of the most enduring fiction of our time, including the national bestsellers We Were the Mulvaneys and Blonde, which was also a finalist for the National Book Award and the Pulitzer, and the New York Times bestsellers The Falls and The Gravedigger's Daughter. She is the Roger S. Berlin Distinguished Professor of the Humanities at Princeton University. Her new book, which she'll discuss tonight with Michael Silverblatt, is unlike any book she's ever written. I Could Not Put It Down. A Widow's Story is a poignant, intimate memoir about the unexpected death of her husband of 46 years and the wrenching and surprising aftermath. It illuminates one woman's struggle to comprehend a life without the partnership that had sustained and defined her for nearly half a century. It's about the anguish of loss and the disorientation of the survivor, and these ultimately human experiences are enlivened by the piercing vision, acute perception, and mordant humor that are the hallmarks of the work of Joyce Carol Oates. Michael Silverblatt, as many of you know, is the host of Bookworm, which he originated here in Los Angeles at KCRW 89.9 FM. Michael created this series in 1989 to share his love of literature, poetry, and fiction with the widest possible audience. I think he channels your questions as he's in the midst of an interview. His love of literature and libraries run deep. Aloud has been very proud to present Michael's author interviews over the years, memorably with Marilyn Robinson, Gore Vidal, Nicole Krauss, Susan Sontag, and many, many others. And tonight, I'm sure, will be just as illuminating. Please welcome Joyce Carol Oates and Michael Silverblatt. Thank you.
Well, I'm sure I speak for Michael also in thanking you for that gracious introduction. It's really, really lovely. And what a beautiful library. I'm just astonished. It's so, so beautiful and just so thrilling to be here. And the auditorium is so congenial and warm also. I'm just going to be reading one little chapter from my memoir. And it's a very different sort of writing for me because everything that is in the memoir is real. None of it is fiction. But also, it wasn't written in the way that one would write an autobiography, looking back upon something. It was written as journal entries each night when I came home and couldn't sleep. And so there's a certain breathless air about the entries. And the person who's writing them doesn't know what's coming, not even the next day. So it's a different sort of memoir than the kind that's summary and looking back retrospectively. This is a chapter 13. I'm not crying. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm not crying for any reason. February 17th, 2008. This morning at 7:50 a.m., arriving at the hospital, ascending in the elevator at the fifth floor, turn left to telemetry, breathless, hurrying, eager to see my husband, for always the first glimpse of a hospital patient in his room in his bed unobserved is fraught with meaning, carrying the hefty Sunday New York Times for us to read together. And at the farther end of the now familiar corridor, past the nurse's station, there is room 541. There is Ray's bed, empty, just a stripped, bare mattress. Mrs. Smith, your husband is in room 539. Just this morning, he was moved. We tried to call you, but you must have left home. And so, entering this room, which evidently I'd passed a moment ago without glancing inside, I am trembling so visibly that Ray wonders what's wrong with me. The blood has drained from my face. I am trembling in the aftermath of a shock as profound as any I've ever experienced. But here is Ray in the new bed in the new room. a room identical to the previous room with an identical bedside table and the vase of flowers from friends. He's no longer wearing the oxygen mask, nor even the nasal inhaler, since his oxygen intake has improved. And there is the possibility of his being discharged from the hospital this Tuesday. I should explain kind of quickly that my husband had a very high fever and wasn't breathing well. I took him to the emergency room, and he was diagnosed with pneumonia, which is very surprising to us. Everything seems surprising, though, in retrospect. It would not really seem to be that surprising. He had pneumonia. Then for about 5 days, he was steadily improving, and this is the day before he dies, actually. He smiles at me and greets me. "Hi, honey." But when I lean over the bed to kiss him, a wave of faintness sweeps over me. Suddenly I begin to cry, uncontrollably crying, for the first time since bringing Ray to the hospital. My face is contorted like a child's. "I'm not crying for any reason, but only because I love you," so I manage to stammer, "because I love you so much." And Ray's eyes well with tears too. He murmurs what sounds like something like this, "I'll be knocked out for 2 months." Like drowning swimmers, we are clutching at each other. Someone passing in the corridor outside sees us and quickly looks away. Never have I cried so hard, so helplessly, never in my adult life. And that's actually the last time I cried like this. It was just sort of a convulsive, overwhelming experience, and I haven't had that since. Something like this, "knocked out 2 months." Always I will remember these words, for this is how Ray assesses the situation. Pneumonia has interrupted his life. The days in the hospital in his weakened state will result in his editing work being slowed and delayed. Ray was editor of the Ontario Review, a literary magazine that we founded in 1974. He isn't thinking of the future in the way I've been thinking of the future. He's thinking of the May issue of Ontario Review, the responsibility he bears to the writers whose work he's publishing, meaning a deadline, paying his printer, and so forth. He isn't thinking of anything so petty as himself. Maybe Ray isn't capable of thinking of himself in the terms of which I can think of him. Maybe no man is capable of thinking of himself in the terms of which a woman can think of him. "Lean on me, Mr. Smith, that's good." A physical therapist named Rhoda, a very nice woman, is walking with Ray in the corridor outside his room in the effort of exercising his leg muscles. Lying in bed for several days has weakened Ray's legs. It's astonishing how quickly muscles begin to atrophy. How bizarre all this would have seemed to us a week ago. Shuffling man in hospital pajamas, trying not to wince with pain, leaning heavily on a young woman therapist's arm, an IV gurney tugged in his wake. As Ray is walking, unsteadily leaning on Rhoda, but he is walking, I'm thinking, don't fall, please. In the hospital corridors, it isn't uncommon to see patients walking slowly with or without therapists, tugging IV gurneys in their wake. All these days, hours, the IV line has been embedded in the crook of Ray's bruised right arm. Dripping in the antibiotic that, like a magic potion in a Grimm's fairy tale, has the power to save his life. An attendant arrives to take Ray to radiology for x-rays. It seems that a, quote, secondary infection, a mysterious origin, quote, nothing to worry about, quote, has appeared in Ray's left lung, which is to say, in Ray's previously uninfected lung. But is this bacterial too? How matter-of-factly this adjective rose off my tongue, bacterial. As one might say, infinity, light year, a trillion, trillion stars, in a naive speech of the non-scientist. The smiling young woman says with a bright smile she lavishes on all patients and relatives who ask such naive questions, "Ma'am, I don't know. The doctor will tell you." Bacterial. One thing that I have come to know, the nightmare vigil has so impressed me for life, we are not so much surrounded by invisible and very greedy life forms as enveloped by them. At every instant of our lives and before our births in the womb, we are flesh vessels for these microscopic life forms that require us for warmth and nourishment. Those bacteria that benefit us we call, with anthropomorphic instinct, good. Those bacteria that seek to ravage us and destroy us we call bad. It's utterly naive, futile, and uninformed to think that our species is exceptional, so designated to master the beasts of the earth, as in the book of Genesis. Infection, That's another problematic term. For by definition, any infection is bad, though some are not so bad as others. Mr. Smith, can you tilt your head this way? That's great. One of the nurses is shaving Ray's jaws that have grown stubbly. This is a task I might have done for Ray myself if we'd thought of it. Your husband is very handsome, Mrs. Smith, but you know that. Without his glasses, eyes closed, Ray does look handsome. His cheeks are lean and remarkably unlined. His forehead is marred by the faintest frown lines, scarcely visible. As a nurse deftly shaves him and wipes away lather, I feel a sense of unease at Ray's becoming adjusted to the hospital setting, ever more comfortable with the eerie passivity such a setting evokes. As in Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain, in which the young German Hans Karstorp arrives as a visitor at the tuberculosis sanitarium in the Swiss Alps in the decade before the outbreak of World War I, and, as if in a fairy tale enchantment, he remains for 7 years. After Ray is shaved, he returns to the New York Times scattered across his bed. The visit to radiology seems to have had no discernible effect upon him, one in a succession of hospital tests. But both his arms are bruised and discolored from blood drawing. Even for a stoic, the constant blood drawing is becoming painful, but he doesn't complain. Ray isn't one to complain. And how does the remainder of the Sunday pass? Languidly reading, talking, listening to choral music played on a Sunday arts channel on TV. Once listening to a recording of Mozart's Requiem Mass, Ray had remarked in that bravado way in which, when you're young, you might speak of dying and death as if you had not the slightest fear of it, "Promise me you'll play that at my funeral." But you said the same thing about Verdi's Requiem Mass. I did. This was years ago in another lifetime, living in Detroit, Michigan. In the hospital on this February afternoon in 2008, decades later, I don't want to think of this, of our innocence and ignorance. Hospital vigils inspire us to such nostalgia. Hospital vigils take place in slow time during which the mind floats free, a frail balloon drifting into the sky as into infinity. In the late afternoon of Sunday, February 17th, 2008, as dusk comes on and deepens to night, it's decided between us that I will go home early today and return early in the morning. How exhausted I am suddenly, though this has been Ray's best day in the hospital so far, and we are feeling almost exhilarated. Discharged to the rehab clinic on Tuesday, a few days in rehab, and then home by next Friday, next weekend. I kiss my husband goodnight, my very nice husband with his smooth-shaven jaws. It is not an extraordinary leave-taking, for it feels so very temporary. I will be returning to the room so soon. Good night. I love you. Then the title of the next chapter is The Call, and I'll just read the first two lines. February 18, 2008, the call comes at 12:38 a.m., waking me from sleep.
I want to begin by confessing that as the day progressed, I developed a hoarse voice. It seems to be...
I think you sound very intimate and velvety, like a lovely frog down a well. I like frogs, actually.
We've been speaking for in the afternoon, but Joyce and I have been in conversation on and off since I was 17 years old, when, as a very lucky young student, I was invited to lunch at a professor's house. This professor, Jerome Mazzaro, had taught with Wayne and Ray at Wayne State University, and had taught with Joyce and Ray at Wayne State University. And so I was so excited. You know, I think that other than the faculty at Buffalo, Joyce was the first writer I'd met. Wonderland had just been published. She was a very young writer, and I was mesmerized because I could ask questions being so young that I knew were inappropriate. Now I'm older and the questions have to be much more appropriate, and I apologize. But I speak as someone who also knew Ray, and so my terrible luck is that I am a weeper, and I have been weeping in public about David Foster Wallace, and now today, I suppose, about Ray Smith. One can't predict these things, but if you see it, those are tears, and they fall easily in me. And don't think that you have to do anything to help me or even sigh for me. It's just physiological. One of my favorite sentences is that you feel in writing a memoir that a memoir has to be absolutely true, but by being so, it may not be capable of the deeper, capital T, truth that art is yearning for.
Well, I think it's a very good subject and hard to talk about, because of course any writing, any text leaves out a lot. And though everything in my memoir is true, there are many other things I didn't put in. One of the phenomena of mourning and grief is that's very repetitive. Each morning that I couldn't get out of bed for hours was sort of like the previous morning and would be like the next morning. So I kind of truncate that. So art also is very highly selective. And so there are moments in the memoir when I have to stand back from my own particular experience. And then I had mentioned a few minutes ago that it's from journal entries mostly. So I would put at the bottom of the page a little footnote in italics from the perspective of later on, like the widow is thinking this, or she doesn't yet know she's a widow or a widow-to-be. So I was trying to inject something that was more more of an Olympian vantage point in contrast to this very existential, sort of desperate reality of the journal.
One of the things that fascinates me is that you say in the book that you were writing this journal in a nest that you created within your bed, yeah, of books and papers, and if your nest is like mine, pencils and pens that
jab. All sorts of things that get lost, sort of.
But what fascinates me is that I remember staying home years ago to watch Joyce on the Oprah Winfrey show talking about We Were the Mulvaneys, and on that show, in answer to the one literary question they asked, what is it like to write a novel? You said it's like building a nest.
That's right, building a nest with disparate materials, like a pack rat or a crow. You know, those creatures are very, very ingenious and very economical. Yeah. Well, the experience of writing the memoir is just so strange for me, because I didn't intend to write a memoir. And many things happened to me and made me very passive and very weak and losing volition, so that I found myself doing things or even not doing things that were out of character. Like, I found it very, very hard to get out of bed in the morning. Now, when Ray was alive, he would get up quite early, and sometimes he'd go running, and I'd get up fairly early also. The whole morning was kind of a happy time, and, you know, birds are singing, and the cats come in and get fed and so forth. It was kind of a happy time, but suddenly those morning hours were just like lead. And I just sort of noticed that I'm actually not able to get out of bed, and that was weird and scary to me. So it took a long time, and finally, it took a long time, I'm not sure I put that in the memoir, to open my eyes. I shouldn't go on about this, it sounds really morbid. I mean, the idea of when you open your eyes, you've committed yourself to a whole new day, and so you can't then close them again, or it's not fair. It's not kosher. Once you open your eyes, you're sort of committed to this horrible, hideous day that goes on, and you can never really see the end of it. If you have insomnia, I would sort of be awake till about 5 in the morning. So everything became strange. And so the main experience for me was that, like, another personality came into me that was a very corroded and lesser personality. And while I didn't become superstitious, I became very passive. And I'm not really like that.
Well, I find it particularly interesting because one of the most unusual aspects of your early novels were characters who felt volitionless and passive.
Passive, that's right.
In them, in particularly in Do With Me What You Will, characters feel like they're in a trance.
They've been having some shock, some sort of trauma, I guess that was it.
Did you feel as if you had been returned to a state that was younger and less independent?
No, I didn't really think coherently, and I wasn't really thinking much at all. I felt that each day or each hour was kind of a challenge. And now, it's been 3 years or so, I can talk about these things kind of intellectually, but at the time, a widow or perhaps a widower is like a person with a high fever who doesn't think coherently and doesn't necessarily know what he or she's doing, but tries to emulate other ways of behaving. I was always trying to figure out from other people how I should be behaving. And sometimes I would behave inappropriately. I remember when once I was with friends, I was sort of chattering. I'd say, well, Ray would be so surprised to see us right now. And I went on like that, and they were very quiet and I realized this is inappropriate talk. This is not normal talk. So I would be very quiet then. So I was always trying to monitor. But the happiest times were really when I went to teach. Because students, I mean, I love adolescents, they're wonderful people, but they are oblivious of others, you know. The professor comes in the room, they are not staring at the professor to see if this is like a bleeding hunk of a raw flesh or something. They are completely caught up in their own melodramas and their work. And so for 2 hours or even more, I'd be with the young Princeton students, and we're kind of bubbling and ebullient, we'd do their work, and gradually I would forget myself and just sort of become that professor that they thought I was or that I had been in the past. And I'd be really uplifted by that. And at the end of the class, I mean, they wouldn't really know how I was otherwise. And I was describing this to Michael before. It's like, oh, there was a balloon there in my shape, but then when I went home, that balloon just started to deflate, so that finally it was like this little puddle of rubber on the floor. Then the next morning, I would try to blow the balloon up again, and I just sort of kept on doing that. It sounds weird and bizarre, but I do remember doing that.
Well, I remember that the classroom is for you a place of impersonation. I remember before you wrote Blonde, you once told me that you used to speak to the class in a breathy Marilyn Monroe voice.
Oh, when I did the Marilyn Monroe, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
To see if they would notice, and that very few of them did.
Well, teaching is very, very interesting. There may be some teachers in the room. You really put on, you become your better self or your best self, I think, when you're with other people. And then, of course, you always have a text. I could be teaching Hemingway or Faulkner or doing one of the student work. And you're sort of focusing, like there might be 12 people focusing intensely on a text. And you don't encounter that anywhere else, except maybe with Michael Silverblatt. But out in the world, you know, people are not looking so reverently and appreciatively at an actual book. And that's a kind of wonderful experience.
It is. You talk here about Indian Camp, the Hemingway story.
That's right. That's
which
right.
is, you know, for many of us. Do you know the story? Yeah, I hope so. If you don't, please. It's 5 pages long. And it encompasses in a single story an experience of birth and death that's unforgettable.
It's a masterpiece, and he was very young. I teach it because he was about almost as young as my students. And so we read it line by line, and I say he was only like 23 or so when he wrote it.
I wanted to point out, you see, you made a mistake in the... And not to embarrass, but I've always been fascinated by that story. Because you remember they always used to talk so much, those writers at that time, about point of view. In the bottom bunk, there's an Indian, a Native American woman. But it's called Indian camp. Can I say Indian woman?
Is she the bottom or the top?
You say she's at the top, but she's at the bottom. And I'll tell you why she's at the bottom. It's very interesting.
I thought the blood ran down.
It runs down exactly from above. Her husband slashed the throat, and it runs down the hanger. But Nick, who's there looking, is so frightened seeing his father sew the pregnant woman up with fishing cord that he moves away from the bed, which puts him at an angle to see the upper bunk where he sees the husband who's just slit his throat. And he says that he feels as if he's learned everything that night. And I remember being so young in high school and wondering what he'd learned. And you only, about birth and death, only that. But it's so astonishing when you think of that story as being, it's literally about the change of angle. One looking straight ahead, he sees birth. He backs away from the double bunk so that he can look up.
Interesting, yes. Yeah, so one of the things that he learns, he says, he asks his father, why did he do that? And the father said, I don't know. I guess he just couldn't take it any longer. And I think that's profound, you know. Why otherwise do people commit suicide? You can list all these reasons, but basically couldn't take it any longer. That seemed like, that's what he learns also. And then we think that Hemingway and his father both committed suicide, you know, in the future. It's very profound. And my students, or maybe all adolescents, are so interested in suicide that it's kind of uncanny. And there's a good deal of meditation about suicide in my memoir. And the fact that the students are interested in it, then they all seem to know someone who has committed suicide, which is kind of frightening. And when they talk together amongst themselves and when they write their stories, that becomes a preoccupation. So I have to be the person who's the professor, you know, and almost pretending that I don't notice about this preoccupation and focusing on other issues and looking at the writing rather than the theme.
But at the time, you were feeling suicidal.
Well, I was, but I would never allow anyone to know that.
Yeah.
You know, that was... Also, it comes and goes. It's sort of oscillating.
But I wonder, you know, because they used to tell us, and I think it's true, that art would be one of those ways that would help us to solve the dilemmas that made us feel suicidal.
I think that's true for some people, maybe more than for others. I didn't feel that art or my own writing was much of a consolation. People are very surprised to hear that, but I guess I should just tell the truth. I mean, I'm friendly with Elaine Pagels, who wrote the Gnostic Gospels, and you've probably heard of Elaine. Elaine was a young widow. She lost her husband when she was quite young, maybe not even 30. But she said to me that she had been the same way. She couldn't work for a year. Her writing, her scholarship, it just really kind of recedes, you know. And it's like something that you used to do, but you're not even able to concentrate right now. So that was a surprise. But I think for people who aren't living closely with another person, with a partner or a husband or lover or whatever, when there isn't that closeness and somebody in the family dies who's not living with you, that can be a shock, but it's not a visceral shock. You don't walk around the house not seeing the person who wasn't living there. And that's the creepy, eerie thing about losing someone who's been in your life, because you swear that person is somehow here, but you can't find the person. And you wake up in the middle of the night and the person maybe is in the other room. And that goes on for a long, long time. People feel that way about pets. you know, like the cat that isn't there any longer, or the dog that should be lying here, and it just breaks your heart because it's the physical absence, it's ontological absence from the world is so shocking. Whereas when my parents, whom I loved very much, when they passed away, they were up around Buffalo, New York. They weren't in my house, and so it was a different kind of mourning.
And yet the house became significant there too, because there was a wing that was built for them.
Yes, yes.
And here the house becomes the location for a lot of deep feeling, not just remembering the room that was built for your parents, but the garden that Ray had made.
Yeah, everything is saturated with the memory of the other person, and maybe this is quite commonplace, but I just started closing off rooms, and I would kind of walk along a little pathway and go to my room, my study, and not even look elsewhere. So the house got smaller and smaller. It was very, it was sort of a deteriorating situation, except because I went out. I had to go out to impersonate myself and to teach and give lectures and all that. I couldn't deteriorate because I always was going out, whereas I would think that I'd been left by myself, I would just have stayed in that house.
Along with the fear of deterioration is the fear that you will break down in public and that you don't want to, that it feels humiliating. And as I was reading this, so many of your characters have had the feeling
yes.
of being in public.
That's right.
Being watched and judged.
Yeah. Well, some people who have never given public appearances or speeches, they feel that the most terrifying thing would be to stand in front of an audience, give a speech. I think it's number one fear, and the second fear is dying. You know, whereas people like us who do speak in public, we feel that we're in a friendly context and we don't really feel that kind of terror. But I think when you take away a person's self-esteem and some physical strength, because losing someone makes you sick and tired, you know, then all these childlike fears and primitive fears start coming back.
Does writing have any relation for you to those primitive fears? Because you've spoken of it as exorcism, even in this book. I wondered about that.
Well, I don't really know. The kind of writing I did for the memoir is a little different from my usual writing, because I did write it in the nest, and I was sort of writing late at night, and just writing, you know. And so it isn't quite like the writing that I would do in the daylight with a different part of my brain. I'm not sure how to answer that. For my writing self, my usual writing self, the great joy is the revision. I write something out. I revise constantly. And now with a computer, I just write chapters over and over again, like I'm working on a new novel. And each time I think I've gotten the chapter and I move on, then I go back to the beginning and I rewrite a little more. And successively, I feel better and more excited about it. It's like building a building that you're making stronger and stronger. In the beginning, you thought it was good, but then every time you go around it and fix it up, it gets stronger and more interesting, and more things are coming into it. That's the way I think of writing. To me, that's the happiness and joy of writing, and reading too. When you reread or see a play like Macbeth, you see several times, you get a lot out of it. But the writing that I did in the nest of the journal was not that kind of writing. That was more raw and unmediated, and I didn't revise it except to select. I took things out, but I left things in, sort of breathless things.
And yet it seems to me, I can think of nowhere that I've seen this experience of widowhood more completely rendered. It seems that if that was your goal, then writing in that way could only have been a very good solution, because so much of it seems is unconscious.
Yes.
And catching things out of the corner of the eye and from a part of the mind.
Yes.
That is otherwise inaccessible.
Yes, I started getting these strange pains and symptoms, and I didn't know what they were. And then like 100 pages go by, and somebody who read the memoir said to me, I knew on page 89 you were getting the shingles. But see, but I didn't know that. And so when I went back to put it together, I didn't change that. You know, I could have had a footnote. Now she's getting shingles.
Well, the shingles is horrifying. It comes while you're reading your husband's manuscript, which you had never read. When you met him, he had wanted to be a writer. And this was a book that he'd worked on for a very long time, and that you hadn't read. He hadn't read your writing, your fiction. He would read your criticism, but this was an area of mystery.
Yes, but I should say, just parenthetically about the shingles, it was a relief to get shingles because that's real. I thought, this is a real illness, and it's not psychological or, you know, neurotic or whatever. So that's just a parenthesis. I don't mean to interrupt what you're saying. But some people, I mean, I felt very passive. I thought, well, if I'm getting sick, then I should get sick or I deserve to get sick. And that sort of justified being miserable in a way that the other didn't seem to. Yes, I went to Ray's work, and he had published a number of essays and critical articles. He had a PhD in English. He was an 18th century scholar, and he loved poetry. He wrote a lot about modern 20th century poetry. So I was reading his various critical articles, and it was so touching because he had such a feel for poetry. And then I had his manuscript, which was never finished, and it had a lot of X's and things crossed out, and it wasn't typed. And then there were pages of outlines and different endings. And it just seemed so heartbreaking. He had set it aside, and he didn't really care about it anymore. I think it was one of the things of his life that if I had brought it up, he would have said, oh. He said, we would have said, didn't I throw that out? You know. But then seeing it so many years later was very touching.
And
disturbing.
But you had, in the meantime, written many, many novels. And I know that you've seen other writers, Joyce's Decade on Finnegan's Wake, or writers, I think, like Cynthia Ozick, who says, or would say, that every word was like a drop of blood. Mm. To go to a manuscript that couldn't be completed, in part, you say, because it was so close to him.
Very close. Yes, I had so many thoughts about it. First, I was afraid to look at it, and then I became very obsessed with it, and I've read parts of it over and over again. But if Ray were here, and I often think that he's sort of listening, it was really, really good that he didn't continue. Because he had almost a genius for editing, and everybody loved him, and that became his career. He became a wonderful editor, and other writers loved him. Whereas if you're the writer, that's an uneasy kind of career, and you always feel sort of insecure. But if you're an editor, you choose people you like, and he worked with them and helped young writers, for instance. So he had a happy career, and then he was a gardener, and all gardeners are optimists. You know, they go out and put things in the ground, and the things come up. Whereas if you have a tragic sense of life, you don't really understand. You put something in the ground, it just dies, you know. Or I would put something in the ground, and then the tomato worms would come the next day and visit it, or Japanese beetles. Things like that. So I have more of a tragic sense of life in the garden, whereas Ray would just be optimistic, and those slugs came and Japanese beetles, he'd just kind of get rid of them and put new plants in. And that's a really different kind of personality. But writing can be very obsessive. in some people. And he'd gotten in a situation, I think, and I would tell him this, it's not a secret, where he was sort of turning his wheels. He worked on a manuscript for quite a while, and when you're turning your wheels with a manuscript, it goes deeper down into the mud, but you're not moving forward, and that's a problem. And one of the obvious open secrets of being an artist of any kind is that you do move on. You write the first novel. Let's say it's not To Kill a Mockingbird. But it's like something like Soldier's Pay, which is a Faulkner novel no one's ever heard of. In other words, you sort of start off modestly, and then you write your next novel. Maybe about the third, fourth novel, then you write The Sound and the Fury, you know, you're sort of working up to it. But if you're working for years and years and years on that first novel, that's not a good sign, because your youthful energies are being plowed into this. And I thought that it was good that Ray put that aside, because he could just be working on it for 20 years.
You, in Widow's Story, you talk about working on a story that, if I'm not mistaken, is based on one of the most tragic stories in modern poetry, in modern times. The wife of a poet who killed herself and her child. And this was the story you felt that you might be able to finish during this time.
I was working on that, yes. Yes, I'm sure you're one of the few people in the whole world who knows about that story. See, I can't write anything that Michael Silverblatt won't exactly know where it comes from and what it relates to.
No, you see...
But that is true, because you are the quintessential reader. He's the reader that you can't put anything past either.
Let me defend myself. If you do,
I'm praising you.
No. I Joyce has praised me most of my professional life, and has been the source of several great honors. When she had completed Blonde, I was sent the manuscript and was allowed to be the very first person who spoke to her about it. In fact, the publisher sent out my interview with the book to critics so they wouldn't make mistakes about what kind of novel
it was. Well, they made them anyway.
Yeah, you can't help these things. But if you sit, as I do, in a chair across from a writer that you admire, for weeks and weeks, this particular tragedy was spoken of so many times to me by so many different writers, including the writer whose Washington, D.C. apartment was the site of the double murder. And so it was, you know, it was not something that I, you know,
it wasn't that secret.
It was, yes, and it was terrifying. Who could expect that someone one knew, you know, had a wife who killed the child and who had felt such a sense of betrayal? And everywhere I went that summer...
Yes, me too.
I went up to the woman poet's publisher. I was up north, and they had her manuscript and were trying to decide, could they publish the manuscript after such a sensational event, and would they be blamed by the poetry world if they published it and it created that sensation, the manuscript by the woman who killed her baby and herself. I think everywhere one went...
That summer, that's yeah. Right. Yes, I felt the same way.
It was horrifying. But what I'm wondering about is that this is, I think, one of the most difficult stories of the writing life one has heard. How did it become something you felt you could work on at such a difficult and emotionally draining time?
it's about somebody who's in real life committed suicide and also murdered her quite young baby to revenge herself upon a man to whom she wasn't married, actually, who had sort of left her or couldn't commit to her. And I had known her a little bit, and I knew him a little bit also. So I tried to change things so it wasn't so completely obvious. But I was very sympathetic with both of them, because she's going to kill herself out of a sense of feeling worthless. She feels worthless. And often when women feel quite worthless, they take their children with them. They consider the children part of themselves, and they consider it all a terrible failure, that the man has rejected her and the baby, and he's rejected her, so she has to punish herself. And so I wanted to sort of work with that. I felt very worthless myself, and I was just sort of working with this idea. And then, of course, the poet is estranged from her. He doesn't want to be dragged down by her. And I was sympathetic with him, too. He's going to survive. He's literally at a Zen monastery, and he's trying to get to some other level of consciousness. And I was sympathetic with both predilections, one to punish the self, the other to sort of rise above the self. And I was sort of working on it, but it took me a long time to write that. I remember sitting at a different table. I tried to have different ways of, since I couldn't work very well, I would find new places to sit, you know, and new tricks and so forth. And that really took a long time.
A final question before we go to the audience for questions. You meet at the end of this book, at a dinner party at your house, a man who you will subsequently remarry. People writing about the book saying, I guess because I knew Ray, I felt one couldn't speak of the next marriage in the book that was there to create the life of the man you'd been married to. But when these criticisms emerged and you had in some sense written about the death of your husband and brought it to a public, when they responded, why doesn't she say she's been remarried? Did you, as I did, I felt none of your business.
Well, I did say it in interviews, but I was focusing on the first 6 months when it's so hard, you know. Then after that, my insomnia went away, and then after that I started being more normal. But I said a few minutes ago that everything that happened to me seemed very beyond my volition. And that's a strange experience, too, that I felt that, well, maybe I'll get sick. Maybe someone will break in the house because I failed to lock the door. Maybe, and many things just seem to be that happen, you know, or the shingles happen, so it just happened. And then at the end of the summer in Princeton, most people are gone away because it's very hot. So I was there in my house, and my dear friend, a dear friend, had been treated very badly by her companion of 17 years. They were living together and had a beautiful house. He not only left her, but he had been having an affair with a graduate student who was pregnant. So her drama was like a melodrama. Mine was actually more of a low key. Mine was more of a depressed experience. Hers had all these operatic qualities to it. But we did email in the early hours of the morning, and I said, well, I think you're suffering more than I am. She said, oh, no, you're suffering more than I am, and back and forth. But out of all that, she suggested, or I suggested, why don't we have a dinner party where people bring things, because we're sort of all alone, and there are isolated people in Princeton, people who are divorced, people left behind, people single, people whose families are up on the Cape, but they're somehow back in town. So we had sort of a misfits dinner with all these people who didn't have anywhere better to go to. It was for Harry Frankfurt, the very distinguished philosopher at Princeton, whose wife was away for, and we were told to take care of Harry. And so he came as like the guest of honor. And then Yvette invited another person who was a neuroscientist whom I'd never met or never heard of, actually. And then he turned out to be, I mean, months and months later, quite a while later, my next husband. But I remember when he came through the door, he was carrying some food, and I'd never seen him before, and I just sort of said hello, and it was like a blur, you know, and everything seemed to be just sort of blurringness and happening. And I have to say that I didn't really have much emotion for a long time. I'm not sure that I have any even now. You know, it's like I didn't care that much about being attacked about the book because the worst thing had happened was my husband died. Then after that, if somebody doesn't like the book you wrote, that, you know, that seems really, really trivial. And I would say things like, well, now I don't have to worry about flying an airplane. I used to worry because of when I crashed an airplane and Ray be at home waiting for me. And I said sort of cheerfully to somebody, well, now I don't have to worry about the airplane crashing. I don't care for crashes, you know. And at first people were really kind of, you know, and you feel you're saying inappropriate things that are they're actually truthful things, but you're not only stand-up comedians say these things. A stand-up comedian is some person that's just torn the scrim of taboo away, and they say things that nobody would say except people sometimes think. And you sort of get in that existential position yourself. Like, the worst things happen, so I'm not going to care about these other things.
Let's begin to hear your questions.
Do you feel that as a result of the events, your husband's death and then the book, working through that, that now your future fiction, your novels and short stories will go off in any new directions or something where you feel like you're going to write in a different way about as far as your fiction?
Well, I did revise a novel that I had all finished called Little Bird of Heaven. And since I couldn't write anything new, I had this manuscript, and I thought I would revise every word of it, and I did make it deeper and more poetic. It was suffused with the death of a father, and then I sort of put in that my new feelings about my husband. So the men in the novel become more tender. I think the first time through, they were a little more macho and harsh, but then they exude an air of tenderness now that might not have been there otherwise.
Thank you. You once said that living in Detroit, when you taught there with Ray, I think, made you the writer you became. And I wondered if you would explain what you meant by that. Thank you.
What I meant by that is very, very, very true. I had been a writer who wrote about the country. I was a farm girl. I grew up in a small, unprosperous farm in western New York, and my province was chickens. I fed chickens, and chickens actually don't smell so good. And there's not much of a romance about farms if you're actually on a farm. People who don't know about farms have a whole romance and a sentimentality about it, but not people who actually know chickens and cows and so forth. And I liked my life then, but then I got away from the life and I thought, well, gee, it doesn't actually smell. Wow, this is exciting, you know, a place that doesn't smell like chickens and wet feathers and so forth. But anyway, I wrote a lot about the rural background of my childhood when I was a young writer. So my first couple of novels, or several novels actually, up until including A Garden of Earthly Delights, which is set in a place like my childhood memories and girlhood, farm regions, and this sort of infatuation I have with landscape, which is part of my reason that I write, I think. I love to describe the sky and the land and water and fields and things. And I don't know why, I just never get tired of fields. When Ray and I would go walking, I would say, oh my God, look at the field with goldenrod and things in it. And Ray would sort of look at it. He said, well, it's sort of like the other field. Oh, it's a field. It's something, I guess when I was a young girl, fields with wildflowers and different things just made such an impression on me. But then we went to live in Detroit, Michigan. And Detroit was the first city I've lived in. And not only was it a city, but it was a vast, at that time, booming American city. Now it's depopulated and like a husk of what it had been. But then it was expanding, and there was a lot of money. The racial tensions were operatic. I mean, things were happening all the time. The population was increasing and so forth. So I was living in Detroit, Michigan. And naturally, I looked around me and saw, I'm in a city. And the stakes are so much higher, and everything was so much more exciting. So then I wrote novels that were set in Detroit. For a long time, I set much of my fiction in Detroit. I can shut my eyes now and travel all up and down the John Lodge Expressway, the Ford Expressway, all around the city and down to Grosse Pointe and up to Birmingham and Bloomfield Hills, and all around that city that's so troubled, and along roads that we lived in and where I taught and where Ray taught and Woodward Avenue. It's sort of a whole world just vibrant and sort of pulsing. At that time, it was called Murder City, USA. It had more murders than any other city. And now I think the whole area still has many more handguns than there are people. Because people who have handguns have to have more than one, you know. And so when I got there, and for years later, as years went on, and I was there in 1967, the time of the so-called Detroit riot, I started writing about that. So my whole life changed. I started writing about a city, a kind of symbolic American city. Subsequently, I have written about the country again. I mean, I've sort of gone back and forth. But that was my exemplary city.
I'm one of those nervous people, only with writers. I'm a lawyer, so I speak publicly all the time, but it's so wonderful to talk to you. This isn't my comment, but I do have to tell you I'm from Brockport, New York, because you are the only one who is going to know where that is in upstate New York. Brockport!
Very nice.
My mom's from Orchard Park. My comment, my query, and I'm hoping this is appropriate, in my family, my father died when he was 46, and there were two young kids. I was in high school, and my brother was 6 years younger. And, you know, it was funny because my mother didn't seem to really go through so much of the grief process because she had two young kids at home that needed to be taken to school and needed to da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I'm just wondering if, and I realize this is hypothetical, but do you think your experience would have been different if there had been the other people in the house that were helpless and needy, I guess,
yes,
is a way?
Yes, I think that's probably the case. I think every experience of grief is different. And for some people, having children would not make that much difference because the partner's gone, you know. And I'm sort of thinking of, say, when Ted Hughes left Sylvia Plath and she had the children, it didn't make her any less suicidal. You know, she had these very young children. No reason really why Sylvia Plath had to commit suicide. It was a terrible thing to have done. But I always remember thinking that the children didn't save her, even though she seems to have loved her children very much. But it didn't make any difference. But I think that that's true. And I was existentially alone. I use that word because it means like literally, you know, not theoretically, but kind of literally existentially alone. So you walk in a house that's empty and you hear the silence, and it's the kind of horror washes over you that you're all alone, but only if you're not used to being alone. If you're used to being alone, then it's a positive thing. I have friends who love to be alone. They don't want to live with anyone. But I wasn't in that situation. But I did have two cats. And the whole cat situation, we don't have to talk about it here. But they were very disappointing. The kitties, unlike a nice dog who would have come and just, you know, licked my face and put his chin on my lap, the cats blamed me for Ray disappearing. And they would run away from me. They'd look at me. They'd allow me to feed them and eat a little bit, then they kind of run away. And though it sounds ridiculous now, and I can laugh at it now, at the time, the cat's rejection of me was almost devastating, because I rely on my nest, and I'd be calling a cat. I'd say, kitty, 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 and nobody would come. And I even had little tidbits in the bed that I would kind of feed them. They didn't come for that. So I go out and walk tiptoe through the house and put the light on, and there is a cat just lying sort of on the floor looking at me with those reflector eyes with no glimmer of recognition. And I'd say, please come with me, kitty. And no. And so that went on for a while, and I think that was crazy and humiliating. But I put that in the memoir because it was so... it was ridiculous. And a lot of things I put in the memoir are ridiculous. And I wanted to put that in because I think memoirs about grief don't acknowledge how crazy things are. Like the most devastating thing that happened after Ray died, in like second, I came in his study and I had his things on the death certificate and the will and all these things on the floor because I was so brain damaged I couldn't figure out where anything was, so I had everything out there. And Raynard had come in and urinated on him because he was angry. So he urinated on the death certificate. You know, I come in, oh my God. I said, Raynard, bad cat. Bad cat, you know. And I thought, am I completely crazy? You know, it's like you have the script of King Lear, there's some tragedy in your life, but then there's a Marx Brothers movie that's on you. And that was the last straw when the cat did that, so I had to wash it off. Then I had to give these death certificates. I had to sort of give them to people because, you know, you have to do that. And they had seal of the state of New Jersey on it. So all those things, at the time it wasn't funny, though. At the time I didn't think it was funny. But now it does seem, it seems funny now. But Raynard passed away. The other kitty, she forgave me now, and she sleeps with me. They're so fickle. I mean, and I would cry, bad cats. And they would just pretend to be afraid. Like they run, you know, they skitter. And they were mocking me, I think. They were afraid at all. They were laughing at me.
Yes, thank you so much, both Michael and Miss Oates. I was wondering, you spoke of having a tragic sense of life. Was it your experience in Detroit that fed that?
Well, I wouldn't say so much in Detroit. I think looking at the history of humankind, thinking of life, there, from the perspective of Darwinian evolutionary theory, let's say, life is a matter of struggle. Species are struggling to exist and to survive, individuals within species, and the weak specimens and the weak species pass away. And there's no tragedy there because that's basically evolution, and that is the great drama of nature. And it's pitiless, literally, because there's no pity. But then you look upon a humankind and human civilization, we should be able to rise above nature, but we replicate the same struggle for existence and the same swooping in upon territory that we desire and eradicating or practicing genocide on the people who are there. We want the territory. Animals branch out and they want territory. It's nature has much to do with territory. And so the history of humankind replicates the Darwinian struggle for existence. And so if you look at life that way, you will see that there have always been wars, and wars are justified on both sides. The aggressors in wars will justify them by saying X, Y, or Z. They make up some reasons. They say, or it's a religious thing, or they have a banner that says God's on our side, or God says we have to take Jerusalem, or we have to do this, or get some oil. Or, I mean, there's always some reason. There's always a good reason why an aggressor goes in. I mean, I'm sure Hitler had really great ideas, and Stalin had, well, we know that the communists had their great ideas. And Mao and all these people have their great ideas. If you look upon nature and humankind conjoined that way, you can only conclude that struggle is the basic premise of our lives, and that nature red in tooth and claw is replicated in humankind. To me, that is tragic. Now, that doesn't mean that human communities of a small nature can't be based upon love and respect for one another and love relationships and family relationships and teaching and people in communities, particularly small communities. So I would make a distinction between the larger seething nature-ravaged world out there, which is our world right now. Look at all the wars going on. And then I make a distinction between that and the world, the lighted world of civilized behavior and art and liberal sentiments and wanting to help weak people. In nature, weak creatures die or they're pecked to death, but in our human society, we can help weak people or less strong people, and so there's really a difference there. So you can be sort of a pessimist about the long-range vision of life, but you can be more optimistic in the short range, and I think that most teachers are optimists, like gardeners and literary interviewers. He's an optimist. And novelists are optimists because when you start off on the journey, you think you're going to finish it. So you can be pessimistic and optimistic.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
More?
Hey. On boxing, sorry to jump completely to a different book. But I really appreciated the way you broke it all down scientifically, and it just became a base, you know, just on primal objectives. You know what I'm talking about. I'm boxing, right?
Well, I wrote it.
Okay. Sorry, because no, you're just looking at me. I thought maybe it just escaped you completely.
Well, I wasn't sure
Sorry.
What you meant by breaking it down scientifically.
Well, when I read it, appreciating the sport of boxing, it took away the sport. It made it much more like just like, you know, gladiatorial and primal and just kind of just two guys just wanting to basically bash their nose through the other guy's brain. And I'm quoting you on that. And I mean this in a positive sense.
Well,
I'm
no,
not.
I don't think that really was what I was doing.
Okay.
I was looking upon it really in lots of symbolic terms. That was Mike Tyson who said when I hit
Right,
somebody.
Right. And it was Mike Tyson. And I'm sorry. I'm not. It's been a while since I read it. And I'm not trying to just.
Well, Mike and I are not exactly conjoined, you know.
No. I don't know who would be. So. Yeah, the question is, I'm just, and I hate to get political, and the reason this is kind of my through way to get here, is what do you think of the Tea Party?
Wow. That was quite a quantum leap. I don't have great thoughts about the Tea Party. I'm sorry. I was much more interested in where I thought you were going with the unboxing. Because on the boxing ring, the illuminated ring with the lights on and the referee, that's a kind of civilized replication of the natural fight that doesn't have a referee. You know, it takes it up to another level in the rules and history of boxing. So it's a tradition. It's a sport with a history. You know, it takes the primitive desire to conquer another person to another level that's artistic. And boxing is actually somewhat unnatural. It's not a natural thing to box. Boxing is the art of self-defense, and it's an art and it's skill. And a good boxer doesn't get hit and doesn't get hurt and moves around. So a natural, untrained fighter is somebody who just, you know, tries to hit in some crude and clumsy way. But a boxer can be very artistic, especially in the lighter weights, like featherweights and lightweights, where they're moving around and amazingly. So I would say that boxing is very as a complex signifier, but it does signify civilization.
One more.
I liked the book Blonde very much. Did you know Marilyn Monroe, or did you do a lot of research on her life? And is it true? Is it all...
Well, I did not know Marilyn Monroe. I knew a few people. I ran into people later who had known her in New York City when she was studying at the Actors Studio. No, I saw this photograph of a young girl who was about 16 years old. She had brunette hair that was curly. She was very pretty, but she wasn't beautiful or glamorous. She was just very sweet and pretty. And this was Norma Jean Baker when she was 16 years old and a high school student. And I was so stunned at this picture. She reminded me of girls I went to school with and my own mother and girls from upstate New York. She just was like a sweet American girl. And I thought, how profound that this girl in a few years is going to be this Marilyn Monroe. And then after she dies, she'll be mass-produced in that ugly Andy Warhol silkscreen where she looks so ugly and crass and her mouth is very... very crude, and her hair is very artificial looking. I thought, how interesting, the Andy Warhol silkscreen here and this little sweet girl here, and what happened? You know, that excited me very much as a writer, and I thought I could write about American innocence and American politics, the Cold War, and American culture, and all those things could be sort of put in a saga or an epic about the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, and she died in the 1960s, or early 1960s. And so that was the basis. Then I did some reading. I read a couple biographies, but I didn't read in great detail, and I only took a few notes so as not to be paralyzed. And then I saw all her movies that are available. If you want to have fun sometime, see all of Marilyn Monroe's films. You can get quite a few of them where she starts off. And Don't Bother to Knock is what I started. Well, The Asphalt Jungle, actually. That's fantastic. And then Don't Bother to Knock is her first starring role. And she just keeps getting better and better. And she gets different. And she does different things. And Gentlemen Prefer Blondes became the movie that gave the icon of the Andy Warhol icon. But that's only one movie. She did Bus Stop. She did Misfits. She did Niagara, and that was amazing. So all these movies you can see in chronological order, and just sort of see this whole life and career. Oh, and Some Like It Hot, which is just an anomaly. It's just so wonderful. And then, you know, she does Bus Stop, which is kind of tragic, and then Misfits is definitely tragic. And to see all those movies, I saw... the evolution of an actress who had been seriously and tragically underestimated and treated in a derisory way, and she never really got credit. She was always considered a B-level actress in Hollywood. Around the world, she's very famous, but in Hollywood, she had a certain kind of disparaging reputation. So it was very exciting to me to write that. Thank you. Thank you for your questions.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.